for Thursday, February 7, 2008. Welcome, members. Welcome all who are here. A reminder, please turn off your cell phones and BlackBerries before we start. Members, we have three items on our agenda this afternoon. We're going to start with an update on House Bill 2918 from last session. We also have the amendment for the bill we've been working on, and then we will have our first of two scheduled informational hearings on special ed funding for our state. So with that, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2918 from 2007. And we have David Pass, Catherine Light, and Nancy Latino. Oh, Nancy's here, if available. She's here if we need questions of her. So you're all welcome to come up and... Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, sir. I'm Dave Pass. I'm the director of the Health Resources Commission, and we were charged in House Bill 2918 with looking at the evidence for effectiveness of the treatments for what was defined as pervasive developmental disorder. I don't know if they've gone around yet, made up some handouts for you to look at with progress, and I can kind of run through briefly what we've done. Basically, the state participates in a consortium of 11 states, which is called the MED Project, Medicaid Evidence-Based Decision-Making Project, and they are housed at the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at OHSU. What they do basically is evidence reviews on various topics that the states choose amongst the 11 states. We were able to leverage our involvement with state to get them to take a look at effectiveness for treatments for autism. When I first got involved in this, I didn't take this position until May. They already had that somewhat underway. I was allowed sort of access to the researchers, which is somewhat unprecedented, to be able to massage what they were covering. I think I've gotten them to expand their report. It was originally due in December of last year. Because of the additions they've made, it'll look like it'll be, well, actually they're promising me February 14th for my initial evaluation, and then able to release to my committee on the 25th. So we believe that they're going to cover a large portion of what we're interested in, but we don't know the exact scope, which is normal for that type of review, until we actually see it. We put together a committee, and I provided you with a list of the committee members and sort of their backgrounds and what they do, so that you have some sort of an idea of the diversity of the committee. It's a fairly diverse committee, and just as an aside, four members of the committee have family members who are autistic, so we have a fairly good representation of people who are well involved in the issue. We have been working to identify the important literature, of which there's a large amount, approximately 500 papers published in a 10-year period, and trying to weed those down to relevant ones, hampered a little bit by the fact that we don't know everything that's been covered in the MED Project report, and we don't obviously want to duplicate their work. We've developed a work plan, which I've also provided to you in the packet. That, if I may use a non-technical term, is somewhat mushy depending on exactly when and what we get from the MED Project, but obviously we'll have to cover the areas that we're not interested in, that they were not interested in covering, that we are interested in. We had our first meeting on February 1st of the committee, and it was basically sort of a background meeting. I brought in a speaker from the Oregon Evidence-Based Practice Center to give a presentation to the committee members to have them understand exactly what's involved in evaluating research and taking a very sort of professional approach to looking at research, what's important in making good quality research, that sort of thing, which was well received by the committee. Also, Representative Greenlick came and presented and talked a little bit about what the legislative intent was and sort of the background to why we had this task. Our next committee meeting is scheduled for March because, again, we're waiting for the report, and then the committee members wanted a couple of weeks to take a look at it. in the work plan that we have here for you, the idea is to have a draft report done by June. It could actually be as late as August or September, just depending on how much we have to cover. Once we see what's in the MED report, we will need to evaluate, you know, what areas they didn't cover, and from that point, continue with our own evaluation.
Very good. Members, questions?
Thank you. I'm sorry, I've not really gotten in or studied or looked at this. That sounds like a good effort. I do have a constituent, and I'm not sure if it's in my district or represented Burley. She's talked to me and presented a lot of information. I don't know if she's here today. But when you're doing this study, have you looked at the Lyme disease, if that is any correlation between Lyme disease and identification of autism?
I'm going to mess up the protocol, but Representative Whitman, sorry. Basically, we have not actually started to single out exactly what is important. If there's something, and I encourage this actually, if there's anything that you have that you think is of particular importance that you would like us to look at, and I will note Lyme disease down.
We'll
be happy to take a look at what's out there. I somewhat doubt the MED project will have looked at it, but we can certainly search for literature on that.
Thank you very much.
I could comment on that. At one time I got very familiar just a few years ago with the etiology of autism, and I have never seen a single paper that shows any shred of evidence relationship between Lyme disease and autism. But the problem is Lyme disease is so rare that if every single person that got Lyme disease in the United States got autism from it, you still wouldn't notice it in the blip in the autism tsunami, which really is huge.
That's true. Yes, sir. Follow up, and I'm not going to compete with the representative to my left as far as medical and research. But
her, I love some data.
She's saying that they're misdiagnosing autism, and it's really Lyme disease, and her whole family has Lyme disease, and the symptoms are the same.
Yes, I can imagine she'd say that.
Thank you, Representative, for bringing that forward. Thank you. I appreciate you being here. Representative Roland?
Yeah. I just want to make a general statement about this whole issue with autism and the fact that the specialists that the state has that come help individual schools and the regional people are really pretty remarkable in our state. You know, autism, we've been doing this rural county thing, and we have this all the saying in the counties that if you've seen one county, you've seen one county. It's about all you can make conjectures. Well, when, as a principal in a school, when you've seen one young person with autism, you've seen one young person with autism, because it affects so differently each one of these children. And to have the knowledgeable people we have working in our state that come to the schools and help hard-working educators every day figure out what this particular person needs. And I will tell you, if autism kids do one thing for all of us, it is to really help educators understand that every one of us learns differently. But these people help us truly understand how remarkably succinct and we have to act if we want to improve their behaviors, and so that they have an opportunity to be more and more self-functioning in our society. And when you have that connection, it is remarkable to see the growth and the ability that these young people have to continue to grow and to continue to find a place for themselves in our society. And we've come a long way in that, and I think goes a lot to the people who are at those regional autism specialists that come and help day to day with our people. And relieve some of the pressures and the intensity of families. Having been in a family where all the boys are dyslexic, parents feel some real guilt about learning disabilities in general. They internalize that as family members and as parents, and they think if they hadn't done this or done that or whatever, and because like autism, we don't really know why. They think it's something they ate or something they did, or I mean, they internalize it all the time. And these regional specialists kind of can give them a scope, a readjustment. You know, there's lots of other people. They all try to do exactly the same things. You did what you thought you should do. Don't take the guilt. Just work with your child. And we've come a long way. We have ways to go, but I want to commend them. And I think looking at these kinds of reports is really important. We need to keep track of the costs and all those other kinds of things. But at the individual level, we have to remember these are individual human beings who have every right to live fulfilled lives, and they can, and it takes dedicated people, and I'm impressed with the staff that I had the opportunity to work with in the regional bureau. So thanks for the opportunity.
Thank
to
you, Mr. Representative Lynn.
Yes, I'd like to have some fundamental information, such as what's the percentage of the children in effect of autism? Do you, if you know?
Well,
and then that sometimes it could easily misdiagnosis of the autism. Some children more active and then unstable, they could be diagnosed as autism, and when they grow up, 15, in 18, 20, they just like an even better human being anyone else. So sometimes it is very difficult for me, as far as I'm concerned, to define, you know, who is autism or not. I'm sure, you know, this is a fundamental question, so if you could respond that, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Buckley, Representative Lim, it's estimated that autism prevalence could be as high as 1 in 150 at this point. I don't think we have a great number on the exact handle. We have seen an increase in the numbers and a continual increasing in the numbers. The problem with nailing down an exact answer to your question comes partly in the answer to your second question, which is diagnostic criteria. The diagnostic criteria have been changing and evolving, and I think that we may be better at identifying people at this point. We may also be seeing a fundamental increase in the incidence of autism. I don't think we've sorted that out yet. The diagnostic criteria will continue to change. Actually, DSM-5 is being written at this point and has been being written for quite a while. So I don't think we have an exact answer to either of your questions, unfortunately, but we're working there. In a way, my personal opinion is that we're at a fairly early stage in understanding this entire entity, and we'll continue to see development, much like we did in other things that we may consider more basic science-oriented 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Thank you.
So, sure, can I comment on that?
Briefly, if you would.
First of all, I want to thank Dr. Pass and the Health Resources Commission. I'm sorry that I've come late. Their willingness to pick up the ball on this one and attacking it wholeheartedly, and I think they're doing a great job. This is such an interesting question, and because there is so little known about it, it really is in flux. For example, the finding is that there are 4 to 5 times as many boys that get autism or that are diagnosed with autism as girls. And you understand that it's like hemophilia where it's only boys and not girls. You can deal with that with the XX, XY chromosome issues that actually probably affect that. But there's a hypothesis that I heard about very recently that when kids are on the lower end of the spectrum, say Asperger's, as I have a granddaughter with Asperger's, that the early socialization of girls may be different than the early socialization of boys, and that girls may be socialized in a way that masks what shows up in boys. And Asperger's kids, for example, have to learn social behavior. They have to learn every single piece of it cognitively. They don't pick up any from the environment. So if in fact we are socializing girls in a way that it masks their inability to interact, we teach them how to interact, and girls have more room to interact differently, say, than boys do, that we just may be missing, either misdiagnosis or simply missing the fact that at birth there are as many girls that are on the spectrum as there are boys, but we've done the therapy earlier, the cognitive behavioral, other kinds of therapy earlier in the normal socialization of a girl as opposed to a boy. And this is such an open, one weekend, had to read 10 cases of papers on autism. I was involved in as a consultant on, and it's just wide open. But I think the next 5 years are just going to just be amazing in the brain sciences.
Thank you very much, Representative. I'm going to allow our other witness to, because she's extremely experienced in this field. I would like to hear from her.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. I'm also the parent of a man who is an adult with autism, so I have been involved since for many years when autism was a rare and very unusual disability to now. My participation in this effort right now is outside the legislation of 2918, but a part of some of the discussions that happened in terms of the Department of Education, the Department of Human Services, identifying what is currently available, what is missing in our systems, and looking at developing recommendations to move forward in how we provide supports and services to children who are experiencing autism, adults experiencing autism, and families. And by autism, the autism spectrum is what I'm referring to. So we have done a number of things that we just wanted to update you on. Within the Department of Human Services, Dr. Goldberg identified a contact person for me in each of the various divisions. We've developed a survey using a SurveyMonkey tool, if you're familiar with those, to try and make the survey as easy as possible in a very complicated system of services to identify what things are available to people with autism spectrum or what services might be modified to be more appropriate, and most importantly, what things do people on the ground identify as issues and problems that they would like to see us address. So, for example, vocational rehabilitation has actually had conversations of how they can better serve adults within the spectrum as they come into the VR system. There are a lot of things going on, and our effort will be to identify some of those things and identify what's working well and what's not working well. The education system is doing a similar process in a number of forums. The Department of Ed, and Nancy's here and might want to speak on it. The ESD is looking again at what is currently available, what is not available, where people see the holes are, and where we might come back in 2009 with some specific proposals. In addition, there are a number of efforts looking at insurance and other kinds of areas of potential support for addressing people on the spectrum and their families. In addition to that, many states have formed what are called blue ribbon task forces on autism. And, you know, you can sit down with the task force reports, and I've done about 10 to 12 of those task force reports, and they come down to some very concrete and very similar recommendations. So we will be looking at the information that is also coming to us from other states. The plan within the Department of Human Resources is then to compile the information and go on the road, probably in April or May, to share some of those findings in local communities and provide an opportunity for families and people in local communities to respond to what those findings were and what the recommendations are. So we've had an opportunity to create a plan that has had public input and tries to put the best information together that we can gather from the various agencies. So the surveys are out. We're working with the various divisions in gathering the information. It's very complicated, and when you do any kind of survey, it becomes totally irrelevant to the agency that you're asking to respond to. So we've done the best in creating a document, but we're making a lot of adaptations to respond to the diversity of what each of the divisions within the Department of Human Services are doing. So we will have information probably compiled in March, and we've been working with Representative Buckley and making sure that he's aware of what's going on, and we will be bringing the information back.
Thank you. I greatly appreciate it. Actually, I have one more question.
Yes, Representative Lin.
Thank you very much. When the report coming out, I will be interested in reading, but before that, I have
one question, maybe you can eliminate my questions. It seems to me at this time we are having identifying more and more autism from the children, because we have a better tools to identify them, or some kind of a social ills such as drugs and plus family breakdown that's causing the autism. But what is it? Or do we have more here than any other countries? And you know, unless we fix the fundamental problem, if we try to fix it from the outward, it's not going to go away. It's going to be more and more. You know, I'm interested in fixing fundamental problem. Why is it coming from? If you give me my two cents opinion, I think it's coming from the society. It's coming from the culture, from the drugs that people so many use, and the family breakdown. Unless we try to fix fundamental problem, I believe this autism will continue to grow. Can you comment on my comment?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, as a parent of a man with autism, I can tell you that it wasn't drugs, it wasn't family breakdown, it wasn't family dysfunction. He was born with a disability. The research is still unknown in terms of cause. I think that we can say that it is probably, we're going to find it is a spectrum, that there are multiple causes, and that autism is lots of different conditions that fall under a larger umbrella. We know there's a genetic component with some kinds of autism. It may be that there are people in the family. So identical twins tend to both have autism spectrum if they are identical twins. Not always. So it is going to be, and as Dr. Pass said, the research is really looking at what the cause is. And at this point, we really haven't found the smoking gun. It would be really nice if we could say, this is what causes it. Because
this is causing a subsection.
We may be able to identify this piece of it. And there's really interesting data and research that's going on. But I think 5 years, we're going to see a lot.
Okay. Where's that rubber?
And just to comment on one of the other questions about they grow up and then they don't seem to have the problem. I would hope that would be the case in all, that education, we get it right enough that we give them the tools that they need to be able to function in a society that they don't necessarily feel comfortable in. But we have learned how to help them interpret the world in different ways. And I say that in the sense that we have come a long way in working with people with specific learning disabilities, whether they're in math or English or whatever. And I sit here as one of those people who most people who I come in contact with would not know that I was dyslexic. So, and I have brothers. And that I can attribute to my education system and my ability to figure out how other people figure out the world. And it would be the best of all worlds that we identify a whole lot of people and get it right, and then help them, give the tools so they can choose in their life how they want to deal with that. And at the end we say, well, that person doesn't seem to have any problems at all. And we say, that's the beauty of education. Education is supposed to take people from one place and have them the opportunity to get other places they want in their lives. And, you know, I get uptight at times when people say we over-identify because of X, Y, Z. There may be some of that. But in general, what we've done is we've identified people who then we are able to help, and then education gives them the tools to continue the next part of their life. And I, you know, so I would love it if our education system at the end of the day could say, wow, I thought there were a whole lot of autistic children in the world. Where did they go when they got to be adults? Well, they went out to be productive members of our society and did that. And then we can pat all of ourselves on the back that we got it right. And it's people like the one sitting in front of us today who help us keep identifying what are those things that will help us get there.
Very good. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, if I can use a very, very brief comment.
I have Representative Kremels next. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I don't know if this question is in. I have a question and a comment.
Sure.
I don't know if this question is in the realm of of what the bill, because I've been going back through the bill and looking at it, and so indulge me for a second and give me your best shot. But one of the things that it talks about is presentations on approach of literature and evidence-based medicine, an overview with DHS and Department of Education. And what I'm curious about is that in looking at this, and as you're looking at it with the Department of Education, are you going to all, you know, evidence-based medicine has now been around, what, 4 or 6 years? I mean, where it's gotten real, people have gotten real serious, and providers realize it's not going away, and they got to find, you know, they got to use it. But there's also becoming evidence-based practice in education, of teachers, of counselors, of administrators, of, you know, everybody that's involved in education. So what I'm wondering is that as you're looking at, with the Department of Education, as you're looking at the evidence-based medicine side of it, are you also going to be looking at the evidence-based education practice side of it so that the two can really find a place to meld and mix and create, you know, the programs?
This one really sounds more like me.
You go, Doc.
Chair, Representative Krummel. You know, it's interesting that you bring that up. Evidence-based medicine has probably really been around since the Edwin Smith Papyrus, you know, thousands of years ago. But you're right, probably in the last 5 to maybe 10 years, it's kind of taken off. And the stuff that the Health Resources Commission deals with mostly is much more grounded in basic science, looking at pharmaceuticals, et cetera. This is not an area we're not familiar with. We've done reviews on this in the early part, in the early history of the Health Resources Commission, looking at not specifically autism or spectrum, but other behavioral health-related issues. If you'll note in the composition of the committee, to answer your question directly, we actually have someone from the Department of Education, and the very last person on that list is actually somebody who's involved day-to-day and working with autistic kids in the school systems. And when I was trying to put together this committee, to give you a little bit of background, my wife is an educator, my oldest daughter is an educator, and my youngest daughter was just accepted into the education school at the University of Oregon. So I apologize to any of you Beavers. But nevertheless, she is out there, if you will allow the expression, in the trenches on a daily basis, and I felt that perspective was extremely important as one of the many that I wanted to bring to the committee. So yes, we will be looking at that literature as best as it can, realizing, of course, the limitations of education-based and behavioral science-based literature with respect to the type of scrutiny we usually subject this kind of research to. And that actually was part of what that presentation was about that Marianne came to talk about.
Okay. Yeah, just a brief comment, Mr. Chair, and that is I've been in education, I've been a provider, I've worn a lot of hats, and I can tell you that I think the on the evidence-based medicine side, it's going to be very welcome to have the information, because there are a lot of folks out there, a lot of providers, a lot of that do feel that autism, ADHD, so on and so forth, is overdiagnosed. And it for a while, in the early 90s, it seemed like, you know, every kid that walked through the door, well, let's give them some Ritalin and everything will be all right. And we've found out, of course, that that's not necessarily the case. And in education, it's interesting because now a lot of research is starting to be done on educational practices, and they're starting to develop what some of the educational practices should be and evidence that they work and that sort of thing. And especially in dealing with the special ed population, it's going to be even more important that we have that research backup to look at, but also recognizing, as Representative Roblin and Representative Comp have talked about, is that they are also individuals. So it doesn't become cookie cutter, but it becomes a matter of saying, okay, they're exhibiting this, so these are the things that we think we can do that will that will be helpful. And just real quickly to Representative Roblin, you know, part of the reason why you succeeded, in my estimation anyway, with dyslexia is because of your attitude. Because had your attitude been, this is a disability and woe is me and I can't do anything about it, you know, you might be you know, one of the druggies under the bridge or some other place. God forbid.
Right.
But I think that, you know, having the attitude that, hey, it's not going to hold me back and you're going to move forward is very helpful. And I saw evidence of that when I was at Lewis and Clark. I had two students with dyslexia. One that used it as a crutch and as an excuse, and the other that used it that said, I don't care, it doesn't bother me, and I'm going forward.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate it. Representative Greenick, since this was kind of your godchild putting together this part of House Bill 2918, we'll let you finish up here with my thanks for the work you did on this.
Thank you. The first thing that I wanted to say is, if my colleagues who want to get a picture of what it's like to be autistic, there's a wonderful little novel called Strange Case of the Barking Dog. Is that mm-hmm. is that the name? Something very like that. If you haven't read it, it's short and it's wonderful. And it's really written by somebody who's not autistic. He did an incredible job, and it's fast and just fun to read, and it's just kind of amazing. The final point I want to make is the difference between best practice and evidence-based practices. And that's the hard job that Dr. Pass has to deal with. And we learned in health the best practices in the health field were at one time what the professor of the field learned 30 years ago when he was in medical school and is telling his current students. And that's the best practice. If you did anything else, you weren't doing the best practice. And what we learned is that's not necessarily, that may be what he learned 30 years ago, but it's not, and he may be the smartest one in the field 30 years ago, but he's probably, mostly he's, probably not the smartest person in the field now. And the difficult task is to separate those questions of best practices that have some base. And it isn't that everything has to have a randomized clinical trial with 10,000 subjects. It's how do you classify the evidence base across a variety of kind of evidences and mix those best practices, some of which have evidence that they're wrong, let alone no evidence at all from the world. And this is going to be hard because the literature is pretty difficult. So they have a great job in front of them, and we really look forward to it.
We greatly appreciate it.
And we'll be talking to them again on traumatic brain injury, I think,
obviously, this committee has tremendous interest in this issue. We really thank you for being here today. Thank you for the work that you're doing. I look forward to taking your proposals when you bring forward and working with you on legislation in 2009. This is it's a crisis issue for our state, and I look forward to making some progress with it. If it's possible to keep the committee informed via email with whatever materials as you evolve your report, I would greatly appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational hearing on House Bill 2918, and I'm going to open a work session on what's this bill again? Oh, yes, it's the House Bill.
Which one are we
doing? And members, I'll ask our committee administrator to introduce to you the -3 amendment that we have before us for House Bill 3600.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the -3 amendments remove Section 2 of the original bill. The substitute language would permit school districts to request a waiver from the department that allows the district to contract with a contractor other than the state-selected contractor. It requires the department to grant the waiver under certain circumstances and permits that waiver for the 2008-2009 school year only. For your reference, this does have subsequent referral, which is the speaker has given permission for that to be rescinded.
Thank you very much. Members, are the questions of Representative Huffman?
A question of Ms. Richardson, and then a comment. I'm being facetious on the question. I just want to clarify committee rules, whether tomatoes were allowed to be thrown. I assume they're not. I'd like to propose something in the language.
Representative?
Everything looks great, really, but I came across something that I'd like to propose, and it's on, and I'm looking at the proposed amendment sheet.
Correct.
So I'll read off of that. On line 10, where it says, in paragraph 2, the department shall grant.
Mm-hmm.
Let me propose that maybe we change shall to may, and let me explain why.
All right.
I see that since we took out the 95%, which I supported taking that out, there's a there's a possibility, though it's probably remote, but if we put may in there, it allows the Department of Education the discretion to, let's say a school district met all the other criteria, but they were only going to propose testing 50% of their 10th graders for whatever reason that is. Putting may in there would give the Department of Education the oversight ability to ask the district and make sure that they were going to be testing a reasonable number of their 10th graders. Does everybody follow my comments and line of thinking on that?
We do. I do, Representative, and I am looking for the tomatoes. Can I invite Ledge Council to come join us for another happy work session?
It's too nice to throw a tomato.
I do understand your reasoning on that, and I'd like to get Ledge Council's response, considering the entirety of Section 2. Is your understanding that the numbers of students to be tested will be in question, as Representative Huffman brings out?
Okay, for the record, I'm Hannah Lai, Legislative Council. As the amendments now stand, yeah, the number of students being tested did not come into play at all. It is purely mandatory. There's no discretion.
One question.
Representative Rillin.
But as I read it still, the department is contracting with a nonprofit entity to test all students. And so if they're going to ask for the waiver, the requirement is still that they have to test all students.
It doesn't say all students. It's specific to students.
No, at the top in Section 1, it says the Department of Education shall contract with a nonprofit entity to administer nationally normed assessment in collaboration with the department to all students in the 10th grade who are enrolled in public schools. So my assumption is that if that's part of the criteria that they're doing this other thing, that the school would be required to, in the new year, whether they only did 50% in the past, in the new year they'd still be required to do 100% of the kids. I think that's where you're really at, is that when they're testing this next year,
you make
they need to
do
100%.
Okay, Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin. When the waiver comes into play, the number of students is not an issue anymore. It's only an issue when you go under the state directed.
Okay, so there is. So he does have a significant issue with regard to if a district decides to do the waiver, and they have for them providing the test for 50% of their kids, they only have to do 50% this time. They don't have to increase the number.
Representative Greenlee.
Oh, I'm sorry. Answer. Well, I think there are two things. I think the problem is adding may to shall is that allows them to not grant it for any reason,
right?
Not just for this reason. And if we wanted them only to not grant it for this reason, then we need to put something about the proportion of students to make it shall and make a
Here was it happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not willing to go to the cross on this, but it was just a point that I thought we might want to discuss. And
good point.
It is a valid point, and Representative and Ledge Council has confirmed that. I think my response will be that at some point we're going to have to trust some entity in this process, whether it be the district or whether it be the department, and we'll have to trust that this will be a good faith effort on all sides. Again, this only takes us to the 2007-2008 school year. So given the validity of your point, I would still like to move this amendment today and move forward with this. But I do appreciate your point. The department is on record of knowing our intent, and I know that between the two of us, Vice Chair Comp and I will be watching extremely closely to make sure that this gets accomplished the way it's intended to. I appreciate the question, no point, though.
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
Maybe this is not relevant, but sometimes I wondered, I don't think I got the someone explained to me, why do we give them just 1 year, 89, you know? Why not 2 years, why not 3 years? Do they have to apply every year?
Thank you, Representative. The concern from the proponents of having a statewide test, this is a compromise proposal. The proponents that would like a statewide test would like there to be no years, that the statewide test be implemented in this coming school year, 2008-2009. This is a compromise proposal to say, we understand that you would like a statewide test, all students taking the same test. We're asking for 1 year for districts to be able to adjust and give feedback. So it is a compromise bill. You are quite correct in your opinion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
You'll hear from again.
You'll be hearing from them again. Representative Crummels, you have something?
I do, Mr. Chair, and just had a. Is it possible to have Dr. Costi come up and ask
you know,
a couple of questions?
I think it would be just polite of us to do so since he's come here every day
back in the building.
So we should at least thank him and welcome him. So Dr. Costi, if you would please join us.
Because I do have some questions I'd like to ask him. If
thank you, Representative.
All right.
Please do. And if you could stay, we'd appreciate them.
And in the process, Mr. Chair, I guess I have to, you know, as a disclaimer, I don't know whether I'll be shooting an arrow through the heart of this balloon or not, but and I'm not necessarily trying to, but there's just a number of questions that I have.
Well, as noted
about
before, Representative, I am unarmed.
That I think are still pertinent. And the first one, Dr. Costi, thanks for being here, has to do with. The fact that there's an RFP already out and is being executed. And my question to you, Doug, is what happens with that passage of this bill? It'll have an emergency clause on it, which means that it's going to become effective, on passage. It's Section 3. Is that going to have an effect in terms of the amount of money that costs the department to execute the RFP and the contract that's already been, well, the contract hasn't been let, but the RFPs that are out there?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummel, for the record, Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education, and I'm not really a doctor. I'd like to think I was, but...
More than all, don't be so nice.
Yeah, don't be so nice. The RFP is out, like you said, and it's we're planning on closing it February 15th, and we do not see any impact of this language on the outcome of those proposals. We've already put into place specific language to accommodate a cost per test delivery mechanism and deliverable based system.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
I've opened up a work session on, and we don't have a motion on the amendment, so I think we can talk about anything related to the bill. So, yes.
Okay, thank you. Does this put us. Does this put us in any way in compliance, out of compliance, no effect with regards to the No Child Left Behind statutes?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummel, this test has no impact on the No Child Left Behind requirements, other than it provides more information for teachers and students with respect to their instruction.
Okay. And lastly, Mr. Chair, if I may, I think lastly anyway, this is not going to replace the current grade 10 assessment that we do at the state level for all 10th graders that used to be part of what is now the defunct CMCAM. But that test is going to continue to be run. The state assessment has three shots at it during the school year, and it's still taken in the 10th grade as demanded by NCLB, and it meets the NCLB statutes. This has nothing to do with the NCLB, so it's a little bit of a redundancy, but this is the same. I mean, this is where we wanted to go, but I just want to make sure that we're clear on that. Am I correct?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummel, you are correct. This is in addition to the 10th grade OAKS or TESA test.
Okay. One of the things that we might want to consider in the future, Mr. Chair, probably like next session when I'm not here, is to...
Second time you've used that.
Yeah, I know. You were listening on the floor. Is that at some point having the department see if there would be a way to meld these two at grade 10 so that we're still able, as a state, we're still able to meet No Child Left Behind requirements, able to get the information that we need, but be able to do it in an instrument such as this so that we don't have the redundancy in testing. Because if a student takes 3 days to test, you know, because they can take three different shots during the school year, and a fourth day to do this, that's four instructional days that they have used on testing.
That's an excellent point. The superintendent of my local school district, that was her major concern, was taking yet another day on the academic calendar for testing.
Driving the students crazy, too.
They're already crazy.
In response to that, though, I would say that if they're taking either of these tests, most of the kids really do want to know how they compare nationally, and that this is a precursor to a test to get into a college or university they want to get into. So for many of my kids, this would be is a choice they would have chosen to take anyway, even though we're doing the other test, because this one, in many of their lives, they believe is a more significant test than is the one that we're doing. I think they both have merit in different ways, but for many of the kids that I know's perspective, this is, and for some of the counselors, encouraging kids who don't think they should be going, this is a great test for them. Because they say, look at how well you scored, you should really be thinking about college. I mean, it's all over this piece of paper. And I think that's one of the things why schools like having this opportunity for people.
Well, that's why I say, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to see us kind of move in that direction in the future, not expecting it right now and not realizing we're not addressing that issue, but I think at some point in the future,
appreciate that, Representative. I have no doubt they'll be part of the discussion, and I have no doubt that you'll probably even add on even when you're not here, if you hear us talk.
I will try, yes.
I appreciate that. Members, I really was hoping to have Vice Chair Wismut here as well, since he has been part of the negotiations on this. I'm willing to have this.
Just can't get through.
You can't get through. I'm going to have the committee stand at ease for a few minutes. We're going to see if we can get our vice chair here, and then I would like to entertain a motion on the amendment and see if we can vote. So, committee stand on ease. We're going to come to order.
Oh,
believe it or not. Thank you to our committee administrator and Representative Roblin for tracking down Representative Wismut.
Yeah.
And we are back in a work session on House Bill 3600, and I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to come back. Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -3 amendment stated 2708.
Vice Chair Wismut moves to adopt the -3 amendment stated 2708. Is there any discussion?
excuse me, Mr. Chair. I thought we were on 3600. Now, you know, I've been kind of patient here.
I said the wrong number?
No. Representative Wismut read the date, not the bill number.
Oh, okay.
House Bill February 8th.
You want to try that motion again?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We can move that bill, too.
I move to adopt the -3 amendments to House Bill 3600. The -3 amendments are dated 2708.
There you go.
Okay. Vice Chair has indeed moved to adopt the -3 amendments to House Bill 3600 dated 2708. Is there any discussion?
Hearing none. Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair, isn't it?
I move 8.
We have to approve the amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so amended. Vice Chair,
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3600 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation at the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Vice Chair Wilson has moved House Bill 3600 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Kopp.
My only question to the committee at this point is, considering the lengthy debate we've had on this, gee, do we want to put this on the consent calendar?
No, we don't.
I'm teasing.
Did you get a do not pass go, get out of jail card for that rescinding?
Yes.
Do you have an extra one?
Yeah, I know.
We can negotiate after this hearing. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I would just
comment to thank the vice chairs of this committee for their patience and their consideration of all the issues that have been brought up on this issue. Representative Clem.
House Bill 2708 relieves Sun River residents from all obligations for taxation.
Is it wrong?
What? That's the one of the ways we need the money to remove snow from our list.
There you go.
I'm going to ask the committee assistant to call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Nine.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes. You know what? I think I'm the carry this room.
Damn right you are.
And then he was good. All right, thank you, Members.
Thank you, Chair. We can politely ask Representative Crummell to hold his questions.
We could ask.
It could happen.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3600. I'm going to open up an informational hearing on almost continuation of what we've been talking about previously, but dealing specifically with special education funding. And we have Dr. Thomas Parrish and Nancy Latini here to discuss this issue. This is an issue that Vice Chair Kopp is extremely interested in and asked for us to get some information on. I'm very happy to acquiesce to the request.
My name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. I'm here today at your request to have a presentation on special education funding. Your request was very timely because in August we received a report that we had an independent study done on special education funding in Oregon. We were able to secure the person who conducted that study to come and talk to you today, and we're watching the time because he has to fly back to California. I'm pleased to introduce to you Dr. Tom Parrish, who is the Managing Director for the American Institutes for Research in Palo Alto, California. His major area of expertise is fiscal policy and public education with a specialty in special education. He's directed and participated in numerous studies and cost analysis around federal, state, and for local agencies and over the past 25 years. He's also the co-director of the Center for Special Education Finance, which is involved in research addressing the national agenda for special education finance. Oregon's been fortunate to have Dr. Parrish conduct the study that you're going to hear about today, but we also asked him last year to conduct a study, an efficiency study for us on early childhood special education and our regional programs, and we're now working on with the results of that study to start looking at the framework for those programs to make sure we are running them the most efficient way possible. And recently, just within the last month, he completed a study for us on long-term care and treatment and the way we're funding those programs and the program design. So today, though, our focus is on special education in general, overall, and funding, and I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Parrish.
Thank you, Nancy. Welcome, Doctor. Very good to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Parrish, American Institutes for Research. I just want to do a time check maybe before we start because I have a lot of material, maybe too much, and I want to get a sense of how you want me to pace. And
Doctor, we have about 25 minutes left in the hearing today, and if it's workable for you, if you could take 15 to 20 of that and allow us 5 minutes for questions at the end.
Okay. So you're going to see a couple of slides pass through your eyes pretty quickly. But
my apologies.
That's fine. And the full PowerPoint's available if you'd like a copy at some point. It, of course, reflects what's in the report for the most part. Anyway, so I will run through some of these, I think, pretty quickly. The ones that I'm running through actually don't pertain to the study. That's why I'm just going to skip over those. But I just give you a quick overview of what I skipped over. It really just talks about a national perspective on special ed finance and just shows you why it's important, why there's a lot of interest and concern. It's about 13 to 14% of the kids. It's about 20% of the money. And the way states handle this is quite different. It is a federal law, public law 94-142, as I think you all know. know, but the way the states implement the law has a fair amount of variation, particularly when you come to the area of finance. So that's kind of the context, and I think then given the timing, I'm just going to move right into the study itself. And the prelude for the study, the purpose, was to assess and provide feedback on the special education funding formula. So we did that through interviews, stakeholder meetings, review of prior reports, data, and also just knowledge of the research team, because we've done this in a number of other states as well as at the national level. But I think the recommendation should be considered as possibly meriting further attention rather than a specific design for change. And the reason I say that is because the study, I think, was set up to be more of a general inquiry. If you really wanted to say what should our special ed funding formula be for Oregon, I would strongly recommend a much broader committee that would really take some time, because coming from outside the state, it's one of those areas that there are many subjective judgments involved that are quite important. And I think, so these are observations, I think, rather than specific recommendations for change, although we did note some areas that we think you may want to attend to. So just a little bit of an overview of special ed funding in Oregon. As you know, you have a pupil weighting system for education generally in the state, and special ed kids generate twice what a non-special ed child will generate. So it's a 2.0 weighting for kids in special ed. Now, there is an 11% funding cap, though, in Oregon. So you generate twice up to 11%, although there are waivers that can be allowed over that 11%.
11% of what?
Of total enrollment. So 11% of the kids can be claimed against that 2.0 weight. Yeah. And this double weighting, you might say, where does that come from? I think it's a good question given the base, but at least it was attributed to a national study in 1988, and we did that study, so I'm not saying we made it up, but it is need to apply to a specific base. So while the 2.0 came from that study, it matters what you apply that 2.0 against. So, but it's as good as number as any, I think, if you're going to pick a single weight. In addition, though, two major adjustments may be applied. So districts may qualify for more than 11% of its students to generate special education funds. And districts may be reimbursed beyond that 2.0 weight when expenditures for a given child exceed $30,000 for the fiscal year. So that's extraordinary funding for high-cost students that can be forthcoming, and you can get funding even if you have an identification rate higher than 11%, which virtually all districts in Oregon do. We had a couple of stakeholder meetings, and while I said I would think you'd want a broad representative committee to really think about specific recommendations, we did meet with people, but it was more of a hearing, I would say, than it was really trying to come up with specific solutions that would pertain to Oregon. But we did have two half-day meetings, were very helpful, a broad base of people throughout the state, mostly educators. I believe Nancy arranged exactly the membership, so while I met them when we were in the room, I didn't always know all the background, but we got a lot of input at those meetings. They're very helpful. And what do we hear? One major theme that we heard was some supplemental high-cost revenues. So if you go back to that high-cost funding we talked about for kids that are more than $30,000 a year, and that there were some revenues going to districts that were not fully spending their base revenues on special ed. So that's a possible concern. We can talk a little bit more about that. But in other words, you can qualify for that supplemental funding even if you're not spending all your base funding, and that's something we may want to talk a little bit more about. Others argued, however, that the base formula, there's nothing wrong with that, because they argued that the base formula was really not designed. It was designed to determine overall revenues rather than a real blueprint of exactly or very prescriptive notion of how those funds should be spent. So we heard arguments on both sides of that issue. Also, concerns were expressed about a lack of consistency in high-quality special education practice throughout the state. And I think it was less of a concern that Oregon doesn't have high-quality special ed than questions about variations in the provision of service. And so one of the things I sometimes say is the service a child's receiving dependent on the child's need, or is it more dependent on the child's zip code? And in this case, we seem to see that both of those things apparently were coming into play, or there are some some evidence of that, although the data may be a little faulty. But I think that's a very important point, and we did hear concerns about it. We also heard rising number and increasing cost of low-incidence students. Of course, you've been talking about autism today already, and so that is a rising population, and that was an issue that was raised. There also appeared to be some attentions, especially this rising cost of low-incidence students. And with autism, are they low-incidence anymore? That's one question. And since those are often provided through regional service provision, in some ways that growing population, the cost associated with it, in relation to the funding available, perhaps exacerbated some of the tensions between district and regional service provider relations in some cases. Okay, how did they come out? Most respondents seem to favor keeping the current special weight of ed weight of 2.0. So that's one of the questions. Should the weight be greater? Should it be smaller? Should we go to something else? Many states, or most states that have a weighting system, do not have a single weight. Almost all of them have multiple weights. So a weight for an autistic child would be different than a child with a learning disability. But in Oregon, you have a single weight. That question came up, but most respondents seem to favor keeping that single weight. There are also some, the 11% cap was a question because, as I pointed out, virtually no districts in Oregon, or very few, identify kids in special ed at a rate that is 11% or lower, and yet we have this cap. So is it kind of an artifact of the past and a little out of date? There were some differences of opinion about it, but I think generally didn't get strong pressure that that cap should be raised. They felt perhaps it created some, at least symbolic incentive for rising identification rates, which is a national phenomenon. And then the Children's System Change Initiative was also mentioned as a source of some concern. Other issues, fiscal burden of increased accountability, a loss of high-quality paraprofessionals due to No Child Left Behind, and insufficient instructional space. And that is an issue that came out in several of the studies, concerns about space. So let's just look and put these a little bit into perspective, though, because you can talk about the 11% waiver provision, and you can talk about the high-cost funds, and I think you should, and they get a fair amount of the attention in the discussion. But they're a relatively small percentage of the money. So it's important that the basic 2.0 weight, or the basic allocation for special ed, generates by far 90% of the revenues received by local districts for special ed. So while we can adjust these provisions, and that's where a lot of attention might be cast, it's still not the lion's share of the money by a long shot. So one of the issues, though, that also came up was district special ed revenues in relation to expenditures. So I already mentioned that some districts were getting supplemental revenues for extraordinary costs when they weren't spending their base revenues. And so this sort of connection between state and federal special ed revenues and what was reported as being spent was perhaps one of the biggest issues to dwell on in this study. In districts, and first of all, I think we might want to look at the variation in revenues. So if you've got a formula that's pretty straightforward, it seems, at least on its surface, 2.0 up to 11% cap, and yet we see variation in revenues, and this is not just in very small districts where you can see some outliers that are pretty extreme, but even if you take districts with 100 special ed students or more, special ed revenues per student ranged from $4,300 per special ed student to $9,500 per special ed student. So we see a vast range in revenues per student across districts in the state. So it appears to be a very equitable, straightforward formula, but we do see a lot of disparity. Now, if those disparities are related to cost variations, then one can, I think they're more tolerable than if they're not so clearly related. So we'll look at that a little bit more closely. But it does seem surprisingly large, given the relatively straightforward and consistent way that special ed's funded in Oregon. And if you look at this table, you'll see, I mean, basically, it looks at the percentage of kids who are in districts in which the revenues exceed special ed expenditures by greater than 500, or in which expenditures exceed revenues by more than 500. So we're really kind of saying, let's take what we might consider kind of an outliers, where the disparity per student between revenues and expenditures is $500 or more. And what we find is that 80% of the students in the state are in districts in which that kind of disjuncture occurs. 50% of the kids are in districts in which the expenditures exceed the revenues. So one could argue they're underfunded in relation to what they're spending. That's 50% of the kids, at more than 500 per student. While 20% are in just the opposite. They're in districts in which revenues exceed what's being spent by over $500 per student. So only 20% of the, or I'm sorry, it's 30% of the students. So it's 70% are in the outlying bands, 50 and 20, and then 30% kind of fit within what you would sort of think is the band of expectation that there would be a greater alignment. So I think that's an issue that would be worth further exploration. I think it could be a contentious issue. And another way to kind of look at how this breaks out in this table, we took districts with greater than 930 students, special ed students, as compared to districts with less than 930 special ed students. And you might say, well, why'd you pick 930? I mean, that was just an arbitrary number. We really just said, what if you divided all of the special ed students in the state and said, let's put the upper half in terms of district size and the lower half, and it just turned out the breaking point was 930 students. But we wanted to see, is something happening different on average in larger districts as opposed to smaller? And indeed, we found that it is related to district size. Not completely, not uniformly. But on average, we see that in the bigger districts, they're actually spending more than they're getting by about 400 per student, whereas in the smaller, districts, they're receiving about 400 more than they're spending, whereas in the larger districts, they're arguably underfunded by about 700 per student. So it does seem this disparity is not totally arbitrary. It does seem to be related to district size, with district larger districts spending considerably more than they're getting under the formula on average. So I mentioned a relatively few percent on the 11% cap in terms of concerns, so perhaps that's not a major point of contention and shouldn't be focused so much. The high-cost disability funds, though, another issue in relation to them, not only were they awarded to districts that weren't using their base revenues, which you could argue both ways, but I think it's certainly a valid point worth considering further. And also, those funds only came in at 70%. So let's imagine you're a district that was already spending more than you're getting, and you have a good number of high-cost students. Those claims are only being funded at 70% by the state, so that was another point of tension. Arguably, from those districts' point of view at least, especially when some of those funds were going to districts that weren't spending what they're getting already for special ed. They seem to be linked to fiscal flexibility mentioned above. There is some flexibility about how money will be spent. Varying local attitudes towards special ed and the inability of some areas of the state to fully secure related service staff. So I think that affects both the variation in expenditures we saw that were fairly considerable. It also affects, we believe, the variations in service provision that we saw. So you go into some parts of the state, and if you look at least what's being reported about services being provided, and you don't find, for example, many very high percentage of kids in special ed getting speech therapy, just as an example. And when you go and talk to people from those regions, it's like, well, we can't hire people in this region. Now, under the law, that's still a required service. And I think it does raise questions about what one might do, but I think both the variations in expenditure and the variations in service are a potential area of concern that may warrant further investigation. So if you look at the variations in service provision, I mean, how would you know? So I think one of the things, again, you go back to that fundamental question, to what extent are kids getting services under special ed as required by law in relation to their need as opposed to their zip code? And the question, again, is how would you know? And there are data in Oregon, actually, that are quite informative, potentially, in that regard. They tell us per student the services actually received, the percentage of students receiving various services by district, so they're quite descriptive. There are concerns about their accuracy. So, I think they're important data to have. I think one should look at those. And so while they may not be fully comparable in their current form, at least if you take them on face value, they seem to provide clear evidence of substantial service disparities around the state. And again, as that was expressed as an area of concern by people who were in a position, I think, to know about it, I think one has to give some credibility to the data, although probably not take them literally, because there are real questions about how they're reported and so on. But I think the argument was, if the data can't be fairly compared, they probably should be dropped, because they're really out there as public record right now that shows pretty substantial disparities. And I think on the other hand, we really argue, rather than drop them, really fuller implementation should be pursued, because we think it's important to know the real levels of services. It's a costly area. It's an important area. So it's important to know really what's being provided throughout the state. So we feel those data could provide important adequacy and equity of service measures across the state for special ed. But here's what the data show. So if you look at the number of students per special ed teacher is what you see in the top row. And first of all, you're going to look at those numbers and you say, my God, those are terribly high. Well, keep in mind, not every special ed kid is assigned to a special ed teacher. That also accounts kids who are only getting speech therapy. So they may see a speech therapist, but they don't see a teacher. But because we don't know exactly on a per student basis exactly who sees whom, it just gives us overall indication of the number of service providers in relation to the number of students. But what we see here is that, and again, these are just averages, but we do see in the eastern region, for example, the number is closer to 34 as opposed to the northwest, where it's closer to 26, or central, where it's 25.6. So you may say those aren't huge, but if you look at that by individual district, you'll see much greater variation. And then the second row shows special ed student per special ed aid ratios. And again, you can show it in more detail, but the more detail you look at, the more problematic the data becomes. So we simply wanted to show it as an indication. ESD district tensions is another potential issue. Oregon's system of 20 ESDs includes larger regional provision for low incidence and EIECSE services. From an outsider's point of view, at least, which is one of the reasons we were brought in, people with expertise and people from outside the system to take a look, I have to say the system seems complex. We've got three layers of provision. You have districts, you have ESDs, we have regional provision. So it's kind of hard for me to get my arms around that, and I kind of struggled with it for a while. And after having spent a year or so looking at it, I understand a lot better, but I'm going to say I'm totally, I'm not, all the confusion's not gone away. And each level's funded through a different kind of formula that doesn't relate to the other formula. So to me, that's also a problem. And I think it's awfully hard, from my point of view, for the special ed community, for example, to make a coherent argument to the assembly when everybody's kind of coming with different arguments around the same really group of kids and different formulas that kind of add up different ways. I mean, how you'd sort that all out and make a coherent argument decision, I think is problematic. So, I think the system's a little complex. Tensions may be tied to overall concerns that regional funding's not increased in accord with their rising service needs. So, for example, as you know, autism isn't growing, as you just were commenting. And the funding formula really hasn't accommodated that, again, because I think it's a part in a very complex puzzle that's pretty difficult for people to fit together and think about. ESDs, because of all that, then appear under considerable pressure to provide more services for less revenues. And especially when you get around the area of autism, which we know is an area, as you mentioned earlier, that is an area of concern, it just creates tensions, I think, throughout. So multiple regional structures may complicate rational and coherent arguments regarding the state's special ed needs, and the degree of regional overlay may need to be simplified and the funding for these multiple systems more logically linked. And I know I'm getting into a hornet's nest. I fully understand that. I know you've studied this over and over and over. I read some of the reports. I was a little confused by some of those as well, and we can talk about that. But okay. So I still think, because I know there's a long history in this, and that's why I think you really need to have a stakeholder committee to say, look, we can't probably just sweep clean and start all over. We might design a different system if we did. But how much do we want to retain and how much do we want to rethink? And so I think those are tough issues, but this is one area that I think probably requires some consideration. So looking at the funding formula, does the funding formula need to be changed? Well, I would argue across the three funding formulas that I mentioned, I've already argued a more coherent link among them is important. But if you look at just the special ed K-12 funding formula, what are the strengths? Well, it's relatively simple, at least in appearance, and I think that's important. We can say 2.0, people understand that, and 90% of the money comes from that 2.0. So there's some other things on top that are a little more complicated, but even that I think people can understand. If you're 11% cap, a little bit more, you can get some more money. Kids are real severe over 30,000, you can get some more money. So, again, I don't want to underestimate the importance of that, because I've been in states where absolutely no one can figure out the formula. California was one of them. They finally did just sweep it all away because no one understood it and started all over. So it's important that it be somewhat transparent and understandable. So that's a good thing. It appears to treat districts the same, although data don't show this, but it appears to. It's reliable, and it's easy to maintain with a relatively low reporting burden. All these things are important. Possible concerns. The degree of variation in revenues is fairly extreme and disproportionately affects large districts. I think that's a concern. Continuing to disregard disparities based on the premise that the formula is largely designed solely as a basis for allocation may be problematic, in my opinion, due to the rising high need and high cost populations, because of service disparities across districts, and because of complicating arguments for more special ed support for regional programs, for EIECSE services, and special ed services for some districts. So I think that probably I would lean towards the notion that that's somewhat problematic, the amount of disparity that you see, and especially provisions you can still get extraordinary funding even though you're not spending your base revenues. While I understand the argument, I think we're probably moving into an era when that argument's a little increasingly tenuous. So what's a possible change? Prohibit districts from receiving additional funds through the high-cost funding mechanism when they're showing special ed revenue surpluses in the base funding. Other possible modifications would be to factor in a cost of education index, which would likely help urban districts. In other words, a cost of education index simply is something like a cost of living adjustment, although there are actually indices around education. So we can show we have measured that education costs are higher in some areas than others, and the formula could be adjusted based on an index. Last, the state consider a more cost-based approach to special ed funding. Those are all things that could be considered. Let's do that pretty quickly, but I want to leave time for some questions.
You did a great job.
Thank you. There's contact information, and again, this could be made available if you'd like.
Dr., I think all members of the committee would love to receive this report via email if that's possible.
Okay.
We greatly appreciate it. Representative Greenock, do you have a question?
Thank you. I do. First of all, I want to say that the American Institute for Research is an extraordinary institution growing out of World War II research on the human factors around military pilots going off, and they've done some of the most important work in education evaluation your division has, and that's really thank you for doing that. I have a sister-in-law that teaches profoundly handicapped kids, six in a class, probably all of them over the $30,000, and then a daughter who teaches reading disability kids, and it's really clear to me. When you talk about special education, you're not talking about any single entity. This is really quite a huge difference. Why are we weighting those numbers that get to the 2.0? I mean, why don't we have, say, four categories of kids and weight the district's extent to which they go into that factor, and then not have to deal with the 11% or the 30,000 plus? I mean, it just seems obvious to me that would be an ordinary way to do it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, that's a good question. And as I mentioned, actually, one of the slides I slipped over very quickly, but it does show the kinds of formulas that states have. Weighting students, that you do in Oregon, is the most common, but it's still only maybe 20 states. But of the 20-some states that have weighted formulas of that type, Oregon is the only one that has a single weight. Every other one does differentiate by something. Now, there are some rubs. So in a way, it's obvious. I'm afraid special ed finance is always kind of like this. In some ways, it's obvious, but if you look at it carefully, there are arguments to go the other way as well. But the argument that you made as to why why one would do it, I think, is well taken. So why might you not do it? Rates either have to occur on something we can count. So they would count on categories of primary categories of disability, which we know. And, of course, kids, for example, with autism would have a higher weight than, let's say, the average child with a speech-language impairment. But we also find that those categories are somewhat fungible. And so do we then create possible incentives to put kids into higher revenue categories? And that's been argued, and I'm not going to say it's crystal clear, but it's a question that comes up. And incentives around special ed are always a little disconcerting. The other thing you can count is where kids are served. So if I say, well, let's see, it probably costs more to serve that child in that small class with six students with a special teacher than an integrated class with 30 kids and so on. So I should give the higher cost class a greater weight than the lower cost class. But then again, what we found, and in fact Congress finally acted on this out of concern, that in fact we're creating possible incentives for more restrictive placements. So it's dicier than one might think. We've made recommendations around it in different places in different ways because of context and sort of local priorities and so on. But it's not quite as straightforward as one might think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Doctor, thank you so much for being here again. My apologies for not getting you onto the presentation early enough. Greatly appreciate you being here and presenting the information. If the committee could get the copies of it, we will continue the conversation with Nancy the next time we have a chance to focus on the issue.
Thank you. Well, you are getting me on my plane, sure. So I appreciate that.
Can we get copies of this report electronically?
Yeah.
The full
report? Absolutely.
I thought they've already been sent to members.
Oh, they have?
Yes, as of meeting materials, they were sent on Tuesday.
Okay. Thank you.
If you need it,
please let me know if you need another.
Okay, members, that we will not meet tomorrow. So we will meet again Monday. I'm sorry, Representative. I'm sorry, but we will see you again on Monday. Thank you very much. And we're closed.
Nina and I will come anyway. Yeah.